Most of my people have gone from the Kesperat.
Where?
Some of them tortured and killed. Some taken as slave labor.
But now the prodigal returns. Why aren't they happy to see you?
They think I'm probably a spy, or else I'm crazy. Either way, I'm a danger to them. They're going to keep me here to question me. It was either that or a summary execution.
Some homecoming.
At least there's a few of them left alive. When we first got here, I thought...
I know what you thought. So did I. Do they speak any English?
Of course. But it's a matter of pride that they don't.
But they'll understand me?
Don't, Gentle.
I want them to know we're not their enemies, Gentle said, and turned his address to the squad. You already know my name, he said. I'm here with Pai Opa because we thought we'd find friends here. We're not spies. We're not assassins.
Let it alone, Gentle,
Pai said. We came a long way to be here, Pai and me. All the way from the Fifth. And right from the beginning, Pai's dreamed about seeing you people again. Do you understand? You're the dream Pai's come all this way to find.
They don't care, Gentle, Pai said.
They have to care.
It's their Kesperat, Pai replied. Let them do it their way.
Gentle mused on this a moment. Pai's right, he said. It's your Kesperat, and we're just visitors here. But I want you to understand something. He turned his gaze on the woman whose ribbon blade had danced so threateningly close to the mistiff's pate. Pai's my friend, he said. I will protect my friend to the very last.
You're doing more harm than good,
the mistiff said.
Please stop.
I thought they'd welcome you with open arms,
Gentle said, surveying the quartet's unmoved faces.
What's wrong with them?
They're protecting what little they've got left,
Pai said.
The Autarchs sent in spies before. There have been purges and abductions, children taken, heads returned.
Oh, Jesus.
Gentle made a small apologetic shrug.
I'm sorry, he said, not just to Pai, but to them all. I just wanted to say my piece.
Well, it's sad. Will you leave it to me now? Give me a few hours and I can convince them we're sincere.
Of course, if that's what it'll take, Hazar and I can wait around until you've worked it all out.
Not here, Pai said. I don't think that would be wise.
Why not?
I just don't,
Pai said, softly insisting.
You're afraid they're going to kill us all, aren't you?
There is some doubt, yes.
Then we'll all leave now.
That's not an option. I stay and you leave. That's what they're offering. It's not up for negotiation.
I see.
I'll be all right, Gentle,
Pai said.
Why don't you go back to the cafe where we had breakfast? Can you find it again? I can,
Hazar said. She spent the time of this exchange with downcast eyes. Now that they were raised, they were full of tears.
Wait for me there, Angel,
Pai said, conferring Gentle's epithet upon her for the first time.
Both of you angels.
If you're not with us by twilight, we'll come back and find you,
Gentle said. He threw his gaze wide as he said this, a smile on his lips and threat in his eyes. Pai put out a hand to be shaken. Gentle took it, drawing the mistiff closer.
This is very proper, he said.
Any more would be unwise, Pai replied. Trust me.
I always have. I always will.
We're lucky, Gentle,
Pai said.
How so?
To have had this time together.
Gentle met the mistiff's gaze as it spoke and realized there was a deeper farewell beneath this formality which he didn't want to hear. For all its bright talk, the mistiff was by no means certain they would be meeting again.
I'm going to see you in a few hours, Pai, Gentle said. I'm depending on that. Do you understand? We have vows.
The mistiff nodded and let its hand slip from Gentle's grasp. Hazar's smaller, warmer fingers were there, ready to take its place.
We'd better go, Angel,
he said, and led Hazar back towards the gate, leaving Pai in the custody of the squad. She glanced back at the mistiff twice as they walked, but Gentle resisted the temptation. It would do Pai no good to be sentimental at this juncture. Better just to proceed on the understanding that they'd be reunited in a matter of hours, drinking coffee in the oak at noon. At the gate, however, He couldn't keep himself from glancing down the street of blossom-laden trees for one last glimpse of the creature he loved. But the execution squad had already disappeared into the Chianculi, taking the prodigal with them. Chapter 32 1 With the long Isodorexian twilight still many hours from falling, the autarch had found himself a chamber close to the pivot tower where the day could not come. Here the consolations brought by the Crouchy were not spoiled by light. It was easy to believe that everything was a dream, and, being a dream, not worth mourning if, or rather when, it passed. In his unerring fashion, Rosengarten had discovered the niche, however, and to it he brought news as disruptive as any light. A quiet attempt to eradicate the cell of dearthers led by Father Athanasius had been turned into a public spectacle by Quasar's arrival. Violence had flared and was already spreading. The troops who had mounted the original siege were thought to have been massacred to a man, though this could not now be verified because the docklands had been sealed off by makeshift barricades.
"This is the signal the factions have been waiting for," Rosengarten opined. "If we don't stamp this out immediately, every little cult in the Dominion's going to tell its disciples that the day's come."
"Time for judgment, eh?"
"That's what they'll say."
"Perhaps they're right," the autarch replied. "Why don't we let them run riot for a while? None of them like each other. The Scintillants hate the Dearthers hate the Zenetics. They can all slit each other's throats."
"But the city, sir."
"The city. The city. What about the frigging city? It's forfeit, Rosengarten. Don't you see that? I've been sitting here thinking. If I could call the comet down on top of it, I would. Let it die the way it's lived. Beautifully. Why so tragic, Rosengarten? There'll be other cities. I can build another Isodorex."
"Then maybe we should get you out now, before the riots spread."
"We're safe here, aren't we?" the autarch said. A silence followed. "You're not so sure."
"There's such a swell of violence out there."
"And you say she started it?"
"It was in the air."
"But she was the inspiring spark?" He sighed. "Oh, damn her. Damn her. You'd better fetch the generals."
"All of them?"
"Matalaus and Residio. They can turn this place into a fortress." He got to his feet. "I'm going to speak with my loving wife."
"Shall we come and find you there?"
"Not unless you want to witness murder, no." As before, he found Quasar's chambers empty. But this time, Concupiscentia, no longer flirtatious but trembling and dry-eyed, which was like tears to her seeping clan, knew where her mistress was, in her private chapel. He stormed in to find Quasar lighting candles at the altar. "I was calling for you," he said.
"Yes, I heard," she replied.
Her voice, which had once made every word an incantation, was drab, as was she. "Why didn't you answer?"
"I was praying," she said.
She blew out the taper she'd lit the candles with and turned from him to face the altar. It was, like her chamber, a study in excess. A carved and painted Christ hung on a gilded cross, surrounded by cherubim and seraphim. "Who were you praying for?" he asked her.
"For myself," she said simply.
He took hold of her shoulder, spinning her around. "What about the men who were torn apart by the mob? No prayers for them?"
"They've got people to pray for them. People who loved them. I've got nobody."
"My heart bleeds," he said.
"No, it doesn't," she replied.
"But the Man of Sorrows bleeds for me." "I doubt that, lady," he said, more amused by her piety than irritated.
"I saw him today," she said.
This was a new conceit. He pandered to it. "Where was this?" he asked her, all sincerity.
"At the harbour. He appeared on a roof right above me. They tried to shoot him down, and he was struck. I saw him struck. But when they looked for the body, it had gone."
"You know, you should go down to the bastion with the rest of the mad women," he told her. "You can wait for the second coming there. I'll have all this transported down there, if you like."
"He'll come for me here,"
she said. "He's not afraid. You're the one who's afraid."
The autarch looked at his palm. "Am I sweating?"
"No."
"Am I on my knees begging him to be kind?"
"No."
"Accuse me of most crimes and I'm probably guilty, but not fear. You know me better than that."
"He's here, in his orderex."
"Then let him come. I won't be leaving. He'll find me if he wants me so badly. He won't find me praying, you understand. Pissing, maybe, if he could bear the sight." The autarch took Quasar's hand and tugged it down between his legs. "He might find he's the one who's humbled." He laughed. "You used to pray to this fellow, lady. Remember? Say you remember."
"I confess it."
"It's not a crime. It's the way we were made. What are we to do but suffer it?" He suddenly drew close. "Don't think you can desert me for him. We belong to each other. Whatever harm you do me, you do yourself. Think about that. If our dreams burn, we cook in them together." His message was getting through. She didn't struggle in his embrace, but shook with terror. "I don't want to take your comforts from you. Have your man of sorrows if he helps you sleep. But remember how our flesh is joined. Whatever little sways you learned down in the bastion, it doesn't change what you are."
"Prayers aren't enough," she said, half to herself.
"Prayers are useless."
"Then I have to find him. Go to him. Show him my adoration."
"You're going nowhere."
"I have to. It's the only way. He's in the city, waiting for me."
She pressed him away from her.
"I'll go to him in rags," she said, starting to tear at her robes, "or naked. Better naked."
The autarch didn't attempt to catch hold of her again, but withdrew from her, as though her lunacy were contagious, letting her tear at her clothes and draw blood with the violence of her revulsion. As she did so, she started to pray aloud, her prayer full of promises to come to him on her knees and beg his forgiveness. As she turned, delivering this exhortation to the altar, the autarch lost patience with her hysteria and took her by the hair, twin fistfuls of it, drawing her back against him. "You're not listening," he said, both compassion and disgust, overwhelmed by rage even the Crouchy couldn't quell. "There's only one lord in his order, X." He threw her aside and mounted the steps of the altar in three strides, clearing the candles from it with one backward sweep of his arm. Then he clambered up onto the altar itself to drag down the crucifix. Quasar was on her feet to stop him, but neither her appeals nor her fists slowed him. The gilded seraphim came first, wrenched from their carved clouds and pitched behind him to the ground. Then he put his hands behind the Saviour's head and pulled. The crown he wore was meticulously carved, and the thorns punctured his fingers and palms, but the sting only gave fire to his sinews, and a snarl of splintered wood announced his victory. The crucifix came away from the wall, and all he had to do was step aside to let gravity take it. For an instant he thought Quasar intended to fling herself beneath its weight, but a heartbeat before it toppled, she stumbled back from the steps, and it fell amid the litter of dismembered seraphim, cracking as it struck the stone floor. The commotion had of course brought witnesses. From his place on the altar, the autarch saw Rosengarten racing down the aisle, his weapon drawn. "It's all right, Rosengarten," he panted. "The worst is over."
"You're bleeding, sir."
The autarch sucked at his hand. "Will you have my wife escorted to her chambers?" he said, spitting out the gold-flecked blood. "She's to be allowed no sharp instruments, nor any object with which she could do herself any harm. I'm afraid she's very sick. We'll have to watch over her night and day from now on." Quasar was kneeling among the pieces of the crucifix, sobbing there. "Please, lady," the autarch said, jumping down from the altar to coax her up. "Why waste your tears on a dead man? Worship nothing, lady, except in adoration." He stopped, puzzled by the words. Then he took them up again. "In adoration of your true self." She raised her head, healing away the tears with her hands to stare at him. "I'll have some Crouchy found for you," he said.
to calm you a little.
I don't want Crouchy, she murmured, her voice washed of all colour. I want forgiveness.
Then I forgive you, he replied, with flawless sincerity.
Not from you, she said.
He studied her grief for a time. We were going to love and live forever, he said softly. When did you become so old? She made no reply, so he left her there, kneeling in the debris. Rosengarten's underling, Seydoux, had already arrived to take charge of her. Be considerate, he told Seydoux as they crossed at the door. She was once a great lady. He didn't wait to watch her removal, but went with Rosengarten to meet Generals Matalaus and Residio. He felt better for his exertion, though like any great maestro he was untouched by age, his system still became sluggish and needed an occasional stirring up. What better way to do it than by demolishing idols? As they passed by a window which gave on to the city, the spring went from his step, however, seeing the signs of destruction visible below. For all his defiant talk of building another Isordrex, it would be painful to watch this one torn apart, Kesperut by Kesperut. Half a dozen columns of smoke were already rising from conflagrations across the city. Ships were burning in the harbour, and there were bordellos aflame around Licorice Street. As Rosengarten had predicted, all the apocalyptics in the city would fulfil their prophecies today. Those who'd said corruption came by sea were burning boats. Those who railed against sex had lit their torches for the brothels. He glanced back towards Quaeswile's chapel as his consort's sobs were raised afresh. "It's best we don't stop her weeping," he said. "She has good reason." 2. The full extent of the harm Dowd had done himself in his late boarding of the Isordrexian Express did not become apparent until their arrival in the icon-filled cellar beneath the merchant's house. Though he'd escaped being turned inside out, his trespass had wounded him considerably. He looked as though he'd been dragged face down over a freshly gravelled road, the skin on his face and hands shredded, and the sinew beneath oozing the meagre filth he had in his veins. The last time Jude had seen him bleed, the wound had been self-inflicted, and he'd seemed to suffer scarcely at all. But not so now. Though he held on to her wrist with an implacable grip and threatened her with a death that would make Clara's seem merciful if she attempted to escape him, he was a vulnerable captor, wincing as he hauled her up the stairs into the house above. This was not the way she had imagined herself entering Isordrex. But then the scene she met at the top of the stairs was not as she'd imagined either. Or rather, it was all too imaginable. The house, which was deserted, was large and bright, its design and decoration almost depressingly recognisable. She reminded herself that this was the house of Oscar's business partner, Peckable, and the influence of Fifth Dominion aesthetics was likely to be strong in a dwelling that had a doorway to earth in its cellar. But the vision of domestic bliss this interior conjured was depressingly bland. The only touch of exoticism was the parrot sulking on its perch by the window. Otherwise this nest was irredeemably suburban, from the row of family photographs beside the clock on the mantelpiece to the drooping tulips in the vase on the well-polished dining-room table. She was sure there were more remarkable sights in the street outside, but Dowd was in no mood, or indeed condition, to go exploring. He told her they would wait here until he was feeling fitter, and if any of the family returned in the meanwhile, she was to keep her silence. He'd do the talking, he said, or else she'd put not only her own life in jeopardy, but that of the whole Peckable clan. She believed him perfectly capable of such violence, especially in his present pain, which he demanded she help him ameliorate. She dutifully bathed his face, using water and towels from the kitchen. The damage was regrettably more superficial than she'd initially believed, and once the wounds were cleaned, he rapidly began to show signs of recovery. She was now presented with a dilemma. Given that he was healing with superhuman speed, if she was going to exploit his vulnerability and escape, it had to be soon. But if she did, if she fled the house there and then, she'd have turned her back on the only guide to the city she had. And, more importantly, she would be gone from the spot to which she still hoped Oscar would come, following her across the Inovo. She couldn't afford to take the risk of his arriving and finding her gone into a city that from all reports was so vast they might search for each other 10 lifetimes and never cross paths. A wind began to get up after a while, and it carried a member of the Peckable family to the door. A gangling girl in her late teens or early 20s, dressed in a long coat and flower-print dress, who greeted the presence of 2 strangers in the house, one clearly recovering from injury, in a studiedly sanguine fashion.
"Are you friends of Papa's?"
she asked, removing her spectacles to reveal eyes that were severely crossed. Dowd said they were, and began to explain how they'd come to be here. But she politely asked him if he'd hold off his story until the house had been shuttered against the coming storm. She turned to Jude for help in this, and Dowd made no objection, correctly assuming that his captive was not going to venture out into an unknown city as a storm came upon it. So, with the first gusts already rattling the door, Jude followed Hoi Polloi around the house, locking any windows that were open even an inch, then closing the shutters in case the glass was blown in. Even though the sandy wind was already obscuring the distance, Jude got a glimpse of the city outside. It was frustratingly brief, but sufficient to reassure her that when she finally got to walk the streets of Isordrex, her months of waiting would be rewarded with wonders. There were myriad tiers of streets set on the slopes above the house, leading up to the monumental walls and towers of what Hoi Polloi identified as the Autarch's Palace, and just visible from the attic room window was the ocean, glittering through the thickening storm. But these were sights, ocean, rooftops and towers, she might have seen in the 5th. What marked this place as another dominion was the people in the streets outside, some human, many not, all retreating from the wind or the commotions it carried. A creature, its head vast, stumbled up the street with what looked to be 2 sharp-snouted pigs barking furiously under each arm. A group of youths, bald and robed, ran in the other direction, swinging smoking censers above their heads like bowlers. A man with a canary-yellow beard and china doll skin was carried, wounded but yelling furiously, into a house opposite.
"There's riots everywhere," Hoi Polloi said. "I wish Papa would come home."
"Where is he?" Jude asked.
"Down at the harbour. He had a shipment coming in from the islands."
"Can't you telephone him?"
"Telephone?"
Hoi Polloi said.
"Yes. You know, it's a—" "I know what it is," Hoi Polloi said testily. "Uncle Oscar showed me one, but they're against the law."
"Why?" Hoi Polloi shrugged.
"The law's the law," she said.
She peered out into the storm before shuttering the final window.
"Papa will be sensible," she went on. "I'm always telling him, be sensible, and he always is."
She led the way downstairs to find Dowd standing on the front step with the door flung wide. Hot, gritty air blew in, smelling of spice and distance. Hoi Polloi ordered Dowd back inside with a sharpness that made Jude fear for her, but Dowd seemed happy to play the erring guest and did as he was asked. She slammed the door and bolted it, then asked if anybody wanted tea. With the lights swinging in every room and the wind rattling every loose shutter, it was hard to pretend nothing was amiss. But Hoi Polloi did her best to keep the chat trivial, while she brewed a pot of Darjeeling and passed around slices of Madeira cake. The sheer absurdity of the situation began to amuse Jude. Here they were having a tea party, while a city of untold strangeness was racked by storm and revolution all around. If Oscar appears now, she thought, he'll be most entertained. He'll sit down, dunk his cake in his tea, and talk about cricket like a perfect Englishman.
"Where's the rest of your family?" Dowd asked Hoi Polloi, when the conversation once more returned to her absentee father.
"Mama and my brothers have gone to the country," she said, "to be away from the troubles."
"Didn't you want to go with them?"
"Not with Papa here. Somebody has to look after him. He's sensible most of the time, but I have to remind him."
A particularly vehement gust brought slates rattling off the roof like gunshots. Hoi Polloi jumped.
"If Papa was here," she said, "I think he'd suggest we had something to calm our nerves."
"What do you have, lovey?" Dowd said. "A little brandy, maybe? That's what Oscar brings, isn't it?"
She said it was, and fetched a bottle, dispensing it to all 3 of them in tiny glasses.
"He brought us Dotterall, too," she said.
"Who's Dotterall?" Jude inquired.
"The parrot. He was a present to me when I was little. He had a mate, but she was eaten by the Rajami next door. The brute. Now Dotterall's on his own, and he's not happy. But Oscar's going to bring me another parrot soon. He said he would. He brought pearls for Mama once, and for Papa he always brings newspapers. Papa loves newspapers.
She babbled on in a similar vein with barely a break in the flow. Meanwhile the three glasses were filled and emptied, and filled again several times, the liquor steadily taking its toll on Jude's concentration. In fact, she found the monologue and the subtle motion of the light overhead positively soporific, and finally asked if she might lie down for a while. Again Dowd made no objection and let Hoi Polloi escort Jude up to the guest bedroom, offering only a slurred, "Sweet dreams, lovey," as she retired. She laid her buzzing head down gratefully, thinking as she dozed that it made sense to sleep now, while the storm prevented her from taking to the streets. When it was over, her expedition would begin, with or without Dowd. Oscar was not coming for her, that much seemed certain. Either he'd sustained too much injury to follow, or else the express had been somehow damaged by Dowd's late boarding. Whichever, she could not delay her adventures here any longer. When she woke, she'd emulate the forces rattling the shutters and take his order X by storm. She dreamt she was in a place of great grief, a dark chamber, its shutters closed against the same storm that raged outside the room in which she slept and dreamt, and knew she slept and dreamt even as she did so. And in this chamber was the sound of a woman sobbing. The grief was so palpable it stung her, and she wanted to soothe it as much for her own sake as that of the griever. She moved through the murk towards the sound, encountering curtain after curtain as she went, all gossamer thin, as though the trousseaus of 100 brides had been hung in this chamber. Before she could reach the weeping woman, however, a figure moved through the darkness ahead of her, coming to the bed where the woman lay, and whispering to her.
"Grouchy,"
the other said, and through the veils Jude glimpsed the lisping speaker. No figure as bizarre as this had ever flitted through her dreams before. The creature was pale even in the gloom, and naked, with a back from which sprawled a garden of tails. Jude advanced a little to see her better, and the creature in her turn saw her, or at least her effect upon the veils, for she looked around the chamber as if she knew there was a haunter here. Her voice carried alarm when it came again.
"There's somebody here, lady," it said. "I see nobody, especially Sadox." "It's not that, Sadox. I see it, Nordi, but I feel that somebody here still."
The weeping diminished. The woman looked up. There were still veils between Jude and the sleeper's face, and the chamber was indeed dark, but she knew her own features when she saw them, though her hair was plastered to her sweating scalp and her eyes puffed up like tears. She didn't recoil at the sight, but stood as still as spirits were able amid gossamer, and watched the woman with her face rise up from the bed. There was bliss in her expression.
"He sent an angel," she said to the creature at her side. "Concupiscentia, he sent an angel to summon me." "Yes?" "Yes, for certain. This is a sign. I'm going to be forgiven."
A sound at the door drew the woman's attention. A man in uniform, his face lit only by the cigarette he drew upon, stood watching.
"Get out," the woman said.
"I came only to see that you were comfortable, Mam Quezwa."
"I said get out, Sadox."
"If you should require anything."
Quezwa got up suddenly and pitched herself through the veils in Sadox's direction. The suddenness of this assault took Jude by surprise, as it did its target. Though Quezwa was a head shorter than her captor, she had no fear of him. She slapped the cigarette from his lips.
"I don't want you watching me," she said. "Get out! Hear me? Or I shall scream rape!"
She began to tear at her already ragged clothes, exposing her breasts. Sadox retreated in confusion, averting his eyes.
"As you wish," he said, heading out of the chamber. "As you wish!"
Quezwa slammed the door on him and turned her attention back to the haunted room.
"Where are you, spirit?"
she said, moving back through the veils.
"Gone?" No, not gone.
She turned to Concupiscentia.
Do you feel its presence?
The creature seemed too frightened to speak.
I feel nothing,
Quasar said, now standing still amid the shifting veils.
Damn, Sadux! The spirit's been driven out!
Without the means to contradict this, all Jude could do was wait beside the bed and hope that the effect of Sadux's interruption, which had seemingly blinded them to her presence, would wear off now that he'd been exiled from the chamber. She remembered, as she waited, how Clara had talked about men's power to destroy. Had she just witnessed an example of that? Sadox's mere presence enough to poison the contact between a dreaming spirit and a waking one? If so, he'd done it all unknowing, innocent of his power, but no more forgivable for that. How many times in any day did he and the rest of his kind, hadn't Clara said they were another species, spoil and mutilate in their unwitting way, Jude wondered, preventing the union of subtler natures? Quasar sank back down on the bed, giving Jude time to ponder the mystery her face represented. She hadn't doubted, from the moment she'd entered this chamber, that she was travelling here much as she'd first travelled to the tower, using the freedom of a dream state to move invisibly through the real world. That she no longer needed the blue eye to facilitate such movement was a puzzle for another time. What concerned her now was to find out how this woman came to have her face. Was this dominion somehow a mirror of the world she'd left? And if not, if she was the only woman in the Fifth to have a perfect twin, what did that echo signify? The wind was beginning to abate, and Quasar dispatched her servant to the window to remove the shutters. There was still a red dust hanging in the atmosphere, but moving to the sill beside the creature, Jude was presented with a vista that, had she possessed breath in this state, would have taken it away. They were perched high above the city, in one of the towers she'd briefly glimpsed as she'd gone around the peccable house with Hoi Polloi, bolting and shuttering. It was not simply Isorderex that lay before her, but signs of the city's undoing. Fires were raging in a dozen places beyond the palace walls, and within those walls the Autarch's troops were mustering in the courtyards. Turning her dream gaze back towards Quasar, Jude saw for the first time the sumptuousness of the chamber in which she'd found the woman. The walls were tapestries, and there was no stick of furniture that did not compete in its gilding. If this was a prison, then it was fit for royalty. Quasar now came to the window and looked out at the panorama of fires.
"I have to find him," she said. "He sent an angel to bring me to him, and Sadox drove the angel out. So I'll have to go to him myself. Tonight."
Jude listened, but distractedly, her mind more occupied by the opulence of the chamber and what it revealed about her twin. It seemed she shared a face with a woman of some significance, a possessor of power, now dispossessed, and planning to break the bonds set upon her. Romance seemed to be her reason. There was a man in the city below with whom she desperately wanted to be reunited, a lover who sent angels to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. What kind of man, she wondered. A maestro, perhaps, a wielder of magic? Having studied the city for a time, Quasar left the window and went through to her dressing room.
"I mustn't go to him like this," she said, starting to undress. "That would be shameful."
The woman caught sight of herself in one of the mirrors and sat down in front of it, peering at her reflection with distaste. Her tears had made mud of the coal around her eyes, and her cheeks and neck were blotchy. She took a piece of linen from the dressing table, sprinkled some fragrant oil upon it, and began to roughly clean her face.
"I'll go to him naked,"
she said, smiling in anticipation of that pleasure.
"He'll prefer me that way."
This mystery lover intrigued Jude more and more. Hearing her own voice, musky with talk of nakedness, she was tantalized. Would it not be a fine thing to see the consummation? The idea of watching herself couple with some Isorderexian maestro had not been among the wonderments she'd anticipated discovering in this city, but the notion carried an erotic frisson she could not deny herself. She studied the reflection of her reflection. Though there were a few cosmetic differences, the essentials were hers, to the last nick and mole. This was no approximation of her face, but the thing exactly, which fact strangely excited her. She had to find a way to speak with this woman tonight. Even if their twinning was simply a freak of nature, they would surely be able to illuminate each other's lives with an exchange of histories. All she needed was a clue from her doppelganger as to where in the city she intended to go looking for her maestro lover. With her face cleansed, Quasar got up from in front of the mirror and went back into the bedroom. Concupiscentia was sitting by the window. Quasar waited until she was within inches of her servant before she spoke, and even then her words were barely audible.
"We'll need a knife," she said.
The creature shook her head.
"They took at them all," she said. "You seem how a look at and look at." "Then we must make one," Quasar replied. "Sadox will try to oppose our leaving." "You wish to kill him?" "Yes, I do."
This talk chilled Jude. Though Sadox had retreated before Quasar when she'd threatened to cry rape, Jude doubted that he'd be so passive if challenged physically. Indeed, what more perfect excuse would he need to regain his dominance than her coming at him with a knife? If she'd had the means, she would have been Clara's mouthpiece now, and echoed her sentiments on Man the Desolator in the hope of keeping Quasar from harm. It would be an unbearable irony to lose this woman now, having found her way, surely not by accident, though at present it seemed so, across half the Imagica into her very chamber.
"I set sharp as the knife,"
Concupiscentia was saying.
"Then do it,"
Quasar replied, leaning still closer to her fellow conspirator. Jude missed the next exchange because somebody called her name. Startled, she looked around the room, but before she'd half scanned it, she recognized the voice. It was Hoi Polloi, and she was rousing the sleeper after the storm.
"Papa's here," Jude heard her say. "Wake up, Papa's here."
There was no time to bid farewell to the scene. It was there in front of her one moment, and replaced the next with the face of Peckable's daughter, leaning to shake her awake.
"Papa," she said again. "Yes, all right," Jude said brusquely,
hoping the girl would leave without further exchanges coming between her and the sights sleep had brought. She knew she had scant moments to drag the dream into wakefulness with her, or it would subside and the details become hazy the deeper it sank. She was in luck. Hoi Polloi hurried back down to her father's side, leaving Jude to recite aloud all she'd seen and heard. Quasar and her servant, Concupiscentia. Sadox and the plot against him. And the lover, of course. She shouldn't forget the lover, who was presumably somewhere in the city even now, pining for his mistress who was locked up in her gilded prison. With these facts fixed in her head, she ventured first to the bathroom, then down to meet Peckable. Well-dressed and better fed, Peckable had a face upon which his present ire sat badly. He looked slightly absurd in his fury, his features too round and his mouth too small for the rhetoric they were producing. Introductions were made, but there was no time for pleasantries. Peckable's fury needed venting, and he seemed not to care much who his audience was, as long as they sympathized. He had reason for fury. His warehouse near the harbour had been burned to the ground, and he himself had only narrowly escaped death at the hands of a mob that had already taken over 3 of the Kesperates and declared them independent city-states, thereby issuing a challenge to the Autarch. So far, he said, the palace had done little. Small contingents of troops had been dispatched to the Karames, to the Okate Noon, and the 7 Kesperates on the other side of the hill to suppress any sign of uprisings there, but no offensive had been launched against the insurgents who had taken the harbour.
"They're nothing more than rabble," the merchant said. "They've no care for property or person. Indiscriminate destruction, that's all they're good for. I'm no great lover of the Autarch, but he's got to be the voice of decent people like me in times like this. I should have sold my business a year ago. I talked with Oscar about it. We planned to move away from this wretched city. But I hung on, and hung on, because I believe in people. That's my mistake," he said, throwing his eyes up to the ceiling, like a man martyred by his own decency. "I have too much faith." He looked at Hoi Polloi. "Don't I?"
"You do, Papa, you do."
"Well, not any more. You go and pack our belongings, sweet. We're getting out tonight."
"What about the house?" Dowd said, "and all the collectibles downstairs?"
Peckable cast a glance at Hoi Polloi.
"Why don't you start packing now?" he said.
clearly uncomfortable with the idea of debating his black market activities in front of his daughter. He cast a similar glance at Jude, but she pretended not to comprehend its significance and remained seated. He began to talk anyway.
"When we leave this house, we leave it forever," he said. "There'll be nothing left to come back to, I'm convinced of that."
The outraged bourgeois of minutes before, appealing for civil stability, was now replaced by an apocalyptic.
It was bound to happen sooner or later. They couldn't control the cults in perpetuity.
They? Said Jude.
The Autark and Quasar.
The sound of the name was like a blow to her heart.
Quasar, she said.
His wife, the consort, our lady of Isorderix, Mam Quasar. She's been his undoing, if you ask me. He always kept himself hidden away, which was wise. Nobody thought about him much, as long as trade was good and the streets were lit. The taxes, of course. The taxes have been a burden upon us all, especially family men like myself. But let me tell you, we're better off here than they are in Patashokwa or Iamandas. No, I don't think he's done badly by us. The stories you hear about the state of things when he first took over. Chaos! Half the Kesperits at war with the other half. He brought stability. People prospered. No, it's not his policies. It's her. She's his undoing. Things were fine until she started to interfere. I suppose she thinks she's doing us a favour, deigning to appear in public.
Have you seen her, then? Jude asked.
Not personally, no. She stays out of sight even when she attends executions. Though I heard that she showed herself today out in the open. Somebody said they'd actually seen her face. Ugly, they said. Brutish. I'm not surprised. All these executions were her idea. She enjoys them, apparently. Well, people don't like that. Taxes, yes. An occasional purge. Some political trials. Well, yes, those too. We can accept those. But you can't make the law into a public spectacle. That's a mockery. And we've never mocked the law in Isorderix.
He went on in much the same vein, but Jude wasn't listening. She was attempting to conceal the heady mixture of feelings that was coursing through her. Quasar, the woman with her face, was not some minor player in the life of Isorderix, but one of its two potentates, by extension, therefore, one of the great rulers of the Imagica. Could she now doubt that there was purpose in her coming to this city? She had a face which owned power, a face that went in secret from the world, but that behind its veils had made the Autark of Isorderix pliant. The question was, what did that mean? After so unremarkable a life on Earth, had she been called into this dominion to taste a little of the power that her other took for granted? Or was she here as a diversion, called to suffer in place of Quasar for the crimes she'd supposedly committed? And if so, who was the summoner? Clearly it had to be a maestro with ready access to the Fifth Dominion and agents there to conspire with. Was Godolphin some part of this plot? Or Dowd, perhaps? That seemed more likely. And what about Quasar? Was she in ignorance of the plans being laid on her behalf, or a fellow plotter? Tonight would tell, Jude promised herself. Tonight she'd find some way to intercept Quasar as she went to meet her angel-dispatching lover. And before another day had gone by, Jude would know whether she'd been brought from the Fifth to be a sister or a scapegoat. Chapter 33 Gentle did as he'd promised Pi, and stayed with Hazar at the café where they'd breakfasted until the comet's arc took it behind the mountain and the light of day gave way to twilight. Doing so tried not only his patience but his nerve, because as the afternoon wore on, the unrest from the lower Kesperets spread up through the streets, and it became increasingly apparent that the establishment would stand in the middle of a battlefield by evening. Party by party, the customers vacated their tables as the sound of rioting and gunfire crept closer. A slow rain of smuts began to fall, spiralling from a sky which was intermittently darkened now by smoke rising from the burning Kesperets. As the first wounded began to be carried up the street, indicating that the field of action was now very near, the owners of several nearby shops gathered in the café for a short council, debating, presumably, the best way to defend their property. It ended in accusation, the insults and education to both Gentle and Hussar. Two of the owners returned with weapons a few minutes later, at which point the manager, who introduced himself as Bunyan Blue, asked Gentle if he and his daughter didn't have a home to go to. Gentle replied that they had promised to meet somebody here earlier in the day, and they would be most obliged if they could remain until their friend arrived.
"I remember you," Blue replied. "You came in this morning, didn't you, with a woman?"
"That's who we're waiting for."
"She put me in mind of somebody I used to know," Blue said. "I hope she's safe out there."
"So do we," Gentle replied.
"You'd better stay, then. But you'll have to lend me a hand, barricading the place."
Bunyan explained that he'd known this was going to happen sooner or later, and was prepared for the eventuality. There were timbers to nail over the windows, and a supply of small arms should the mob try to loot his shelves. In fact, his precautions proved unnecessary. The street became a conduit for ferrying the wounded army from the combat zone, which was moving up the hill one street east of the café. There were two nerve-wracking hours, however, when the din of shouting and gunfire was coming from all compass points, and the bottles on Blue's shelves tinkled every time the ground shook, which was often. One of the shopkeepers who'd left in high dudgeon earlier came beating at the door during this siege, and stumbled over the threshold with blood streaming from his head and tales of destruction from his mouth. The army had called up heavy artillery in the last hour, he reported, and it had practically levelled the harbour and rendered the causeway impassable, thereby effectively sealing the city. This was all part of the autarch's plan, he said. Why else were whole neighbourhoods being allowed to burn unchecked? The autarch was leaving the city to consume its own citizens, knowing the conflagration would not be able to break the palace walls.
"He's going to let the mob destroy the city," the man went on, "and he doesn't care what happens to us in the meantime. Selfish bastard. We're all going to burn, and he's not going to lift a finger to help us."
This scenario certainly fitted the facts. When, at Gentle's suggestion, they went up onto the roof to get a better view of the situation, it seemed to be exactly as described. The ocean was obliterated by a wall of smoke climbing from the embers of the harbour. Further flame-shot columns rose from 24 neighbourhoods, near and far. And through the dirty heat coming off the OK to Noon's pyre, the causeway was just visible, its rubble damming the delta. Clogged by smoke, the comet shed a diminished light on the city, and even that was fading as the long twilight deepened.
"It's time to leave," Gentle told Hazar.
"Where are we going to go?"
"Back to find Pai Opa," he replied, "while we still can."
It had been apparent from the roof that there was no safe route back to the Mistiff's Kesperet. The various factions warring in the streets were moving unpredictably. A street that was empty one moment might be thronged the next, and rubble the moment after that. They would have to go on instinct and a prayer, taking as direct a path back to where they'd left Pai Opa as circumstance allowed. Dusk in this dominion usually lasted the length of an English midwinter day, 5 or 6 hours, the tail of the comet keeping traces of light in the sky long after its fiery head had dropped beneath the horizon. But the smoke thickened as Gentle and Hazar travelled, eclipsing the languid light and plunging the city into a filthy gloom. There were still the fires to compensate, of course, but between the conflagration, in streets where the lamps hadn't been lit and the citizens had shuttered their windows and blocked their keyholes to keep any sign of occupation from showing, the darkness was almost impenetrable. In such thoroughfares, Gentle hoisted Hazar onto his shoulders, from which vantage point she was able to snatch sights to steer him by. It was slow going, however, halting at each intersection to calculate the least dangerous route to follow, and taking refuge at the approach of both governmental and revolutionary troops. But for every soldier in this war there were 6 bystanders, people daring the tide of battle like beachcombers, retreating before each wave, only to return to their watching places when it receded, a sometimes lethal game. A similar dance was demanded of Gentle and Hazar. Driven off course again and again, they were obliged to trust to instinct as to their direction, and inevitably instinct finally deserted them. In an uncommon hush between clamours and bombardments, Gentle said,
"Angel, I don't know where we are any more."
A comprehensive fusillade had brought down most of the Kesperet around them, and there were precious few places of refuge amid the rubble. But Hazar insisted they find one. a call of nature that could be delayed no longer. Gentle set her down and she headed off for the dubious cover of a semi-demolished house some yards up the street. He stood guard at the door, calling inside to her and telling her not to venture too far. He'd no sooner offered this warning than the appearance of a small band of armed men drove him back into the shadows of the doorway. But for their weapons, which had presumably been plucked from dead men, they looked ill-suited to the role of revolutionaries. The eldest, a barrel of a man in late middle age, still wore the hat and tie he'd most likely gone to work in that morning, while two of his accomplices were barely older than Hussar. Of the two remaining members, one was an Ethak woman, the other of the tribe to which the executioner in Vaneyev had belonged, a Noyanak, its head like hands joined in prayer. Gentle glanced back into the darkness, hoping to hush Hussar before she emerged, but there was no sign of her. He left the step and headed into the ruins. The floor was sticky underfoot, though he couldn't see with what. He did see Hussar, however, or her silhouette, as she rose from relieving herself. She saw him, too, and made a little noise of protest, which he hushed as loudly as he dared. A fresh bombardment close by brought shockwaves and bursts of light by which he glimpsed their refuge. A domestic interior with a table set for the evening meal, and its cook, dead beneath it, her blood the stickiness under his heel. Beckoning Hussar to him and holding her tight, he ventured back towards the door as a second bombardment began. It drove the looters to the step for cover, and the Ethak caught sight of Gentle before he could retreat into shadow. She let out a shout, and one of the youths fired into the darkness where Gentle and Hussar had stood, the bullets spattering plaster and wood splinters in all directions. Backing away from the door through which their attackers were bound to come, Gentle ushered Hussar into the darkest corner and drew a breath. He barely had time to do so before the trigger-happy youth was at the doorway, firing indiscriminately. Gentle unleashed a pneuma from the darkness, and it flew towards the door. He'd underestimated his strength. The gunman was obliterated in an instant, but the pneuma took the doorframe and much of the wall to either side of it at the same time. Before the dust could clear and the survivors come after them, he went to find Hussar, but the wall against which she'd been crouching was cracked and curling like a stone wave. He yelled her name as it broke. Her shriek answered him off to his left. The Nolyanak had snatched her up, and for a terrifying instant Gentle thought it intended to annihilate her, but instead it drew her to it like a doll and disappeared into the dust clouds. He started in pursuit without a backward glance, an error that brought him to his knees before he'd covered 2 yards of ground as the Ethak woman delivered a stabbing blow to the small of his back. The wound wasn't deep, but the shock drove his breath from him as he fell, and her second blow would have taken out the back of his skull had he not rolled out of its way. The small pick she was wielding, wet with his blood, buried itself in the ground, and before she could pull it free he hauled himself to his feet and started after Hussar and her abductor. The second youth was moving after the Nolyanak, squealing with drugged or drunken glee, and Gentle followed the sound when he lost the sight, the chase taking him out of the wasteland and into a Kesprit that had been left relatively untouched by the conflict. There was good reason. The trade here was in sexual favours, and business was booming. Though the streets were narrower than in any other district Gentle had passed through, there was plenty of light spilling from the doorways and windows, the lamps and candles arranged to best illuminate the wares lolling on step and sill. Even a passing glance confirmed that there were anatomies and gratifications on offer here that beggared the most dissolute backwaters of Bangkok or Tangiers. Nor was there any paucity of customers. The imminence of death seemed to have whipped up the consensual libido. Even if the flesh pushers and pill pimps who offered their highs as Gentle passed never made it to morning, they'd die rich. Needless to say, the sight of a Nolyanak carrying a protesting child barely warranted a look in a street sacred to depravity, and Gentle's calls for the abductor to be stopped went ignored. The crowd thickened the farther down the street he ventured, and he finally lost both sight and sound of those he was pursuing. There were alleyways off the main thoroughfare, its name Licorice Street, daubed on one of the bordello walls, and the darkness of any of them might be concealing the Nolyanak. He started to yell Hussar's name, but in the come-ons and hagglings 2 shouted syllables were drowned out. He was about to run on when he glimpsed a man backing out of one of the alleyways with distress on his face. He pushed his way through to the man and took hold of his arm, but he shrugged it off and fled before Gentle could ask what he'd seen. Rather than call Huzzar's name again, Gentle saved his breath and headed down the alley. There was a fire of mattresses burning 20 yards down it, tended by a masked woman. Insects had nested in the ticking and were being driven out by the flames, some attempting to fly on burning wings, only to be swatted by the fire-maker. Ducking her wild swings, Gentle asked after the Nullianak, and the woman directed him on down the alley with a nod. The ground was seething with refugees from the mattresses, and he broke 100 shells with every step, until he was well clear of the fumigator's fire. Licorice Street was now too far behind him to shed any light on the scene, but the bombardment, which the crowd behind him had been so indifferent to, still continued all around, and explosions farther up the city's slopes briefly but garishly lit the alleyway. It was narrow and filthy, the buildings blinded by brick or boarded up, the road between scarcely more than a gutter, choked with trash and decaying vegetable matter. Its stench was sickening, but he breathed it deeply, hoping the pneuma born of and on that fetid air would be all the more potent for its foulness. The theft of Huzzar had already earned her abductors their deaths, but if they had done the least hurt to her, he swore to himself he'd return that hurt 100-fold before he executed them. The alleyway twisted and turned, narrowing to a man's width in some places, but the sense that he was closing on them was confirmed when he heard the youth whooping a little way ahead. He slowed his pace a little, advancing through shin-deep refuse, until he came in sight of a light. The alleyway ended a few yards from where he stood, and there, squatting with its back to the wall, was the Nullianak. The light source was neither lamp nor fire, but the creature's head, between the sides of which arcs of energy passed back and forth. By their flickers, Gentle saw his angel, lying on the ground in front of her captor. She was quite still, her body limp, her eyes closed, for which fact Gentle was grateful, given the Nullianak's present labours. It had stripped the lower half of her body, and its long pale hands were busy upon her. The whooper was standing a little way off from the scene. He was unzipped, his gun in one hand, his half-hard member in the other. Every now and then he aimed the gun at the child's head, and another whoop came from his lips. Nothing would have given Gentle more satisfaction at that moment than unleashing a pneuma against them both from where he stood, but he still wielded the power ineptly and feared that he'd do Huzzar some accidental harm, so he crept a little closer, another explosion on the hill throwing its brutal light down on the scene. By it he caught a glimpse of the Nullianak's work, and then, more stomach-turning still, heard Huzzar gasp. The light withered as she did so, leaving the Nullianak's head to shed its flickering gleam on her pain. The whooper was silent now, his eyes fixed on the violation. Looking up, the Nullianak uttered a few syllables shaped out of the chamber between its skulls, and reluctantly the youth obeyed its order, retreating from the scene a little way. Some crisis was near. The arcs in the Nullianak's head were flaring with fresh urgency, its fingers working as if to expose Huzzar to their discharge. Gentle drew breath, realizing he would have to risk hurting Huzzar if he was to prevent the certainty of worse harm. The whooper heard his intake and turned to peer into the darkness. As he did so, another lethal brightness dropped around them from on high. By it, Gentle stood revealed. The youth fired on the instant, but either his ineptitude or his arousal spoiled his aim. The shots went wide. Gentle didn't give him a second chance. Reserving his pneuma for the Nullianak, he threw himself at the youth, striking the weapon from his hand and kicking the legs from under him. The whooper went down within inches of his gun, but before he could reclaim it, Gentle drove his foot down on the outstretched fingers, bringing a very different kind of whoop from the kid's throat. Now he turned back on the Nullianak, in time to see it raising its fireful head, the arcs cracking like slapsticks. Gentle's fist went to his mouth and he was discharging the pneuma when the whooper seized hold of his leg. The death warrant went from Gentle's hand, but it struck the Nullianak's flank rather than its head, wounding but not dispatching it. The kid hauled on Gentle's leg again, and this time he toppled, falling into the muck where he'd put the whooper seconds before, his punctured back striking the ground hard. The pain blinded him, and when sight returned, the youth was up and rummaging among the arsenal at his belt. Gentle glanced towards the Nullianak. It had dropped against the wall, its head thrown back and spitting darts of fire. Their light was little, but enough for Gentle to catch the gleam of the dropped gun at his side. He reached for it as the delinquent's hand fumbled with another weapon, and he had it levelled before the youth could get his cracked finger on the trigger. He pointed not at the youth's head or heart, but at his groin, a littler target, but one which made the kid drop his gun instantly.
"Don't do that, Sirrah," he said.
"The belt,"
Gentle said, getting to his feet as the youth unbuckled and unburdened himself of his filched arsenal. By another blaze from above, he saw the boy now full of ticks and jitters, pitiful and powerless. There would be no honour in shooting him down, whatever crimes he'd been responsible for.
"Go home," he said. "If I see your face ever again—"
"You won't, Sirrah,"
the boy said.
I swear you won't."
He didn't give Gentle time to change his mind, but fled as the light that had revealed his frailty faded. Gentle turned the gun and his gaze upon the Nullianak. It had raised itself from the ground and slid up the wall into a standing position, its fingers, their tips red with its deed, pressed to the place where the pneuma had struck it. Gentle hoped it was suffering, but he had no way of knowing until it spoke. When it did, when the words came from its wretched head, they were faltering and barely comprehensible.
"Which is it to be?" it said. "You or her? I will kill one of you before I pass. Which is it to be?"
"I'll kill you first," Gentle said. The gun pointed at the Nullianak's head.
"You could,"
it said.
"I know. You murdered a brother of mine outside Potashokwa."
"Your brother, huh?"
"We're rare, and know each other's lives," it said.
"So don't get any rarer," Gentle advised. Taking a step towards Hussar as he spoke, but keeping his eyes fixed on her violator.
"She's alive," it said. "I wouldn't kill a thing so young. Not quickly. Young deserves slow."
Gentle risked a glance away from the creature. Hussar's eyes were indeed wide open and fixed upon him in her terror.
"It's all right, Angel," he said. "Nothing's going to happen to you. Can you move?"
He glanced back at the Nullianak as he spoke, wishing he had some way of interpreting the motions of its little fires. Was it more grievously wounded than he'd thought, and preserving its energies for healing? Or was it biding its time, waiting for its moment to strike? Hussar was pulling herself up into a sitting position, the motion bringing little whimpers of pain from her. Gentle longed to cradle and soothe her, but all he dared do was drop to his haunches, his eyes fixed on her violator, and reach for the clothes she had torn from her.
"Can you walk, Angel?"
"I don't know,"
she sobbed.
"Please try. I'll help you."
He put his hand out to do so, but she avoided him, saying no through her tears and pulling herself to her feet.
"That's good, sweetheart," he said.
There was a reawakening in the Nullianak's head, the arcs dancing again.
"I want you to start walking, Angel," Gentle said. "Don't worry about me. I'm coming with you."
She did as he instructed, slowly, the sobs still coming. The Nullianak started to speak again as she went.
"Ah, to see her like that, it makes me ache."
The arcs had begun their din again, like distant firecrackers.
"What would you do to save her little soul?"
it said.
"Just about anything," Gentle replied.
"You deceive yourself," it said. "When you killed my brother, we inquired after you, my kin and I. We know how foul a savior you are. What's my crime beside yours?